Mahatma Gandhi's body.
El Canel, el de Tata,
Mr. President.
No man, there is a
never, never, and never again.
I have a dream.
Imogen Lamb.
Hello, my guest on Voices today is James Hansen, one of the world's most prominent climate scientists and director of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies. He's been called a catastrophist, a prophet, a modern-day hero, and a cantankerous scientist. More often, he's called the grandfather of global warming. James Hansen brought global warming to the world's attention back in the 1980s. At the time, some scientists were predicting that the world was heading towards much colder temperatures. He created one of the world's first climate models, nicknamed Model Zero, which he used to predict most of what has happened to the climate since. Today, James Hansen concludes that the threat of global warming is far greater than even he suspected. In his book, Storms of My Grandchildren, he warns of an impending catastrophe if global warming is not halted now. This, he says, is our last chance to save humanity. James Hansen, hello.
Thanks for having me. Hello.
Has the situation really become that serious?
Yeah, and it's hard for people to understand it because they don't see that much happening. The problem is, however, that the climate system has inertia because the ocean is 4 kilometers deep, the ice sheets are 2 or 3 kilometers thick, so they don't respond immediately as humans begin to apply forcings to the system. But once they do begin to change, the dynamics can take over and we can pass tipping points and things will happen that are out of our control. And what we see is that we're getting very close to tipping points. So that is the danger. There is observable warming, but so far it's only about a little less than 1 degree Celsius averaged over the planet.
And how close are we getting, according to you, in number of years?
Well, I think that we have to get on a different path with global emissions within the next several years, or we will pass some tipping points. The ice sheets, for example, will become unstable because the ocean is soaking up heat and that melts the ice. And so the processes will go on if we don't get on a different path.
You said back in 2003 that halting global warming requires urgent, unprecedented international cooperation. In view of the failure of world leaders to reach agreement at the recent Copenhagen Climate Summit in December 2009, do you fear that that cooperation is not going to happen?
Well, it's not happening now, but in a way, I was glad to see that they didn't reach an agreement in Copenhagen because what they were talking about was cap and trade. And it's very important for people to understand what the problem is. And by the way, I should mention, since we're talking about policy, that I'm, of course, speaking as a private citizen, not as a representative of the American government, even though I am an employee of the government. But the fundamental fact is that as long as fossil fuels are the cheapest energy, we will keep using them, and all the more so. So the idea of putting a cap on will not work unless the cap covered everything, all fossil fuels across the world. So what is really needed?
A cap meaning a limit to the...
Yeah, a limit. So Kyoto Protocol, for example, was a cap system, but it didn't cap everything. And emissions actually began to increase more and more rapidly after the Kyoto Protocol was adopted. So what we need is an increasing price on carbon emissions. And that's only makes sense because the fossil fuels are not made to pay for the damages that they do. We actually subsidize them, but they don't pay for the damage to human health. The air pollution and water pollution is tremendously expensive, the effects on human health, but also the effects on the environment and on the future that will be inherited by our children and grandchildren. So we should put a rising price on carbon, and it does require that all nations do that. But the main thing would be if Europe and the United States and China would agree to have a price on carbon, then that would be effectively global, because any countries that did not agree to have a carbon tax, you could put a import duty on the products from those countries that were made with fossil fuels. The World Trade Organization already allows that concept as long as it's fair. It's equivalent to the tax in your country. So that's the kind of system that we need, but that was not what they were talking about at Copenhagen.
James Hansen, you started your career as a scientist, a researcher, and you've moved into one of an activist also. Do you remember what point in your career you made that move and why?
Well, yeah, it was a very clear point. I had decided after testifying in the 1980s and realizing how time-consuming and all the problems that went with the public aspect that I wanted to get back to science. And I did keep that vow for 15 years until 2004, in the middle of the Bush administration, when I decided that, you know, I recognized this gap between what was clear scientifically and what the public realized. And I decided I didn't want my grandchildren to say that Opa understood what was happening, but he didn't make it clear. So I decided to give one public talk that I thought, of course, now, and with the benefit of hindsight, I realize that you can't make the story clear in one talk. But I worked very hard in 2004 to prepare this talk. It was supposed to be given in Washington with press coverage. After I had worked 6 months on it, the organization sponsoring it changed their mind, because it looked like George Bush would win the election. I think that's the reason they changed their mind. So I ended up giving the talk at my old university. Professor Van Allen, who was the chairman of the department where I got my degree in physics, agreed to arrange a distinguished lecture. And I did give the talk then, and I realized the public still doesn't understand. So I started to get the next year another talk and another one. And that's the way it's gone the last 5 or 6 years.
And that activism has led you to be arrested for demonstrating in the United States, has added a few detractors, people who've been angered for your support, for example, for nuclear power. Many environmentalists disagree with you on that. Also for attacking President Obama's cap-and-trade system. You're not deterred by any of the criticisms?
No, because the story has really become quite clear from a scientific perspective. I think a scientist is able to be objective, and I think I have now, over the last few decades, been able to acquire a pretty good understanding of the overall problem and the fact that we do have to phase out fossil fuel use. And that, frankly, is going to require that the fossil fuels be more precious. We, in fact, very specifically, what has become clear is that we're going to have to leave a lot of the coal in the ground. We should not exploit the unconventional fossil fuels like tar sands, and we should not even go after the last drop of oil, because it's clear that on the long run, if the ice sheets and if the species on the planet are going to have a stable enough climate to survive, it will require that CO2 be no more than 350 parts per million on the long run. And it's already at 389 parts per million, but it will decrease as the ocean soaks up the CO2, provided we don't put too much of it up there. And that, in turn, then implies these limits on what fossil fuels we can exploit.
But so many people are making so much money from fossil fuels. Do you really think that you can get politicians, governments, to bring in legislation to force companies to leave fossil fuels in the ground?
Well, that, you know, I thought initially it was so logical, the science was so logical, that once we made the story clear, that governments would take the right actions. But what I found is that governments will say the right words, a planet in peril, but their actions don't correspond to that. And I think in part it is due to the fact that fossil fuel industry has a tremendous influence on governments worldwide. So that's why I try to get the public involved, because unless the public begins to put pressure, a lot of pressure, on governments, it's just not going to happen. So getting arrested at a mountaintop removal site was an example of trying to draw attention. It doesn't make sense to cut off the top of mountains to get at the last shards of coal, because we're going to have to try to get that CO2 out of the atmosphere somehow. So it just doesn't make sense.
You say that what's happening to the climate is clear from a scientific perspective, and yet some scientists disagree with what you're saying about global warming, disagree with the findings of the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which says that the warming of the climate system is unequivocal.
Sure. Well, that's expected. There are tens of thousands of scientists, and of course there are going to be some of them who don't agree with what I say has become clear to the relevant scientific community. But that, if governments really wanted to know what is the consensus, all they would have to do is ask the National Academies of Science, for example. The story is clear, and it's any report that would be produced by national academies would make that story very clear. You know, the nature of science is to be skeptical. And so, of course, there are skeptics and there are people who, you know, still believe that smoking doesn't cause lung cancer, for example. So you're always going to have some people who will dispute this. But the balance of evidence is very clear.
You're listening to Voices with world-renowned climate scientist James Hansen. James Hansen, I'd like to take you back a number of years to when you were studying physics and astronomy, back to December 1963, in fact, when you were observing a lunar eclipse with other students. And that was a moment that was to change your life?
Yes, in a sense it did. That was my first experience with science, where a professor at the university realized that there was going to be this eclipse, and it was an opportunity to study the Earth's atmosphere, because when the moon goes into the Earth's shadow, the light that strikes it, you can still see the moon during an eclipse because some light is diffused through the Earth's atmosphere. But the amount of light depends upon the properties of the atmosphere. And it turned out that this eclipse was very dark. In fact, with our naked eye, we couldn't see the moon. The reason was that a volcano, Mount Agung in Indonesia, had gone off in March of that year and had made the atmosphere, the stratosphere, so filled with these sulfuric acid droplets that no significant amount of sunlight was getting through the atmosphere onto the surface of the moon. And that taught me something about radiative transfer and the problem of understanding the Earth's atmosphere. But it was really 2 years later, when Professor Van Allen showed me data from the planet Venus, which showed that the amount of energy that Venus was emitting at long wavelengths where heat is emitted was unusually large, and it implied either that Venus was very hot or else it had an ionosphere that was radiating this energy. And so I wrote my thesis on that topic, on studying the atmosphere of Venus, and then eventually that led to trying to understand the Earth's climate.
Several billion years ago, Venus's atmosphere wasn't that different from Earth's atmosphere now, and there were probably substantial quantities of liquid water on the surface of Venus. Could there have been life there?
It's not inconceivable. Life on the Earth took a long time to get started, but we don't know exactly how long Venus was cool enough to have liquid water on the surface, but we know from the composition of the gases that remain in the atmosphere that it did have much more water at one time, and the sun was dimmer. During the early history of the Earth and Venus, the Sun was about 30% dimmer than it is now. And that's a reason that Venus was cooler and it could have liquid water on the surface. But as the Sun became brighter, Venus developed a runaway greenhouse effect. The water began to evaporate. Water vapor is a very strong greenhouse gas, so we got a feedback effect, and it got warmer and warmer, and then the oceans boiled into the atmosphere. Well, that could happen on the Earth, too, if we really go to the extreme of putting all of the fossil fuels in the atmosphere, and if we set off the methane hydrates. There's a lot of methane that's frozen in the tundra, in Asia and Canada, and on the continental shelves. If the ocean becomes warm enough that that methane is released, it's not inconceivable that we could drive the Earth to a runaway greenhouse effect.
What can people, what can individuals do to help?
Well, individuals need to put pressure on the governments because we will have to have the policies. An individual, his actions to reduce his carbon footprint cannot by themselves solve the problem, because one effect of you using less fuel is that it reduces the demand for it, the price gets even lower, and somebody else will burn it. So you have to have policies that are going to cause fossil fuels to be left in the ground, and we move on to clean energies. And that requires a rising price on carbon emissions.
What about the quality of life if we are to use so much less energy from fossil fuels? There are people who say we're not going to have such a good quality of life. I know you've said it will actually improve.
Sure. Well, a clean energy future, I think, is better. Look at the difference between Europe and the United States. There's a factor of two difference in carbon emissions per person, and the quality of life here is just as good as in the United States. So you have to use the energy more efficiently and move to cleaner energies, and that will not reduce the quality of life.
James Hansen, I have one last question. What discovery do you dream of making?
Well, I wouldn't say it's a discovery. I would like to discover a nation that would be willing to stand up to the other nations of the world and really tell the truth, what is needed to solve this problem. Because what's happening in these international discussions is that nations are kidding themselves. They're talking about promises for reductions by 2050 of some big percentage. But in the meantime, what's happening? We're developing tar sands in Canada. We're going to the deepest ocean to get the last drop of oil. We're continuing to build new coal-fired power plants, which will have a lifetime of 50 to 75 years. So the actions of the governments do not correspond to their statements that we're going to phase out carbon emissions. So if even one nation would really begin to put the pressure on the United States and Europe and China to say we've got to have a price on carbon, then I think it could happen.
You've been sounding the alarm for over 30 years now. Are you more discouraged than ever today?
Well, I realize now that it's a lot harder, that just making the science as clear as possible is not enough. Scientists have to actually help connect the dots, because otherwise the governments will say they're doing something, but then you look at it, you start to make a graph of what's happening with the emissions, and you see they're not really decreasing. They're actually continuing to increase, even though they say they're starting to take actions to solve the problem.
James Hansen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Voices was co-produced for Radio France International by Ariane Gaffury. Our email address is voices@rfi.fr. And a reminder that you can hear this program again on our website, rfienglish.com. Bye for now.